Hey, welcome back, AIMP Nashville Pubcast listeners. This is your host, Tim Hunzi. I have a wild one for you today. We have Dale Dotson. If you've ever worked on Music Row, you know Dale Dotson. He's a publishing icon, and he's just one of our favorite characters on the row. We get into a lot today. We talk publishing, we talk songwriting, we talk about our heroes, we give a lot of information. It's so important to know your history. This man knows it all, so buckle up and enjoy the ride. Hey, welcome back, AIMP Pubcast listeners. This is your host, Tim Hunzi. And for today's episode, we have publishing icon, consultant, just an all-around well-known character on Music Row, Dale Dotson, with us today. I think we're going to have a really fun conversation. Probably not sure where it's all going to go, but it's going to be great. So my brother, Dale, welcome aboard the train.
Thank you, Tim. I'm very excited about doing this. And I love the history of the town, you know, so...
Well, that's what I'm excited to get into some of that. Why don't you just give us a quick background on yourself and tell us what got you here to where you are today?
Well, I came from a small town in West Virginia, Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. I just started, you know, I guess learning to play the guitar and really digging deep into the roots of country music. I guess the first guy that probably hit me the most was Hank Sr., Hank Williams. He probably drove me down that road about 9 or 10. So from that point, Tim, not going into a whole lot, but I started playing festivals and jamborees. And I just kind of did those kind of things and did carnivals and fairs and all that up until I left there. But I was like 14 and stuff. And I was doing some shows with Johnny Paycheck and Ronnie McDowell and doing those package things and just doing area shows in the summertime because I was still going to school and doing sports and all that. But at 14, I got a job at WCST radio station in Berkeley Springs on Radio Hill. It was kind of my college. It was still the old radio thing where you had a right and left turntable and a cartridge, and you had the commercials, and I had to go out and get ads, they said back then. I would just play anything I wanted to play. We didn't really have a thing where, you know, they check what you play because we were such a small station. But at night, I would sit back and just basically shut down the radio station and pull all these 45s out and then put them in on the radio, but the radio wouldn't be on. It's just I would play them in the studio there to see what I wanted to play that next night. And that's where I learned about all those legends and those songwriters like Harlan Howard and Hank Cochran. And then doing that until I graduated and I got down here in about 87, late part of 86, 87, just got out of high school, barely. And I got a job at, I auditioned for Country Music USA at the Opryland theme park. And I was there for 3 years. The Roy Acuff and the Buck Owens and George Jones and Porter Wagner were my four acts that I got to do. I did that for 3 years. And then I found my way to Music Row.
What kind of inspired you to, like, you were a performer, you had a little background, you did radio, so you kind of saw it, but what kind of inspired you to get into to publishing or to really get driven into Nashville on the business side of it?
Well, I guess after I got here, I wanted to be an artist, of course. You know, I wanted to be those guys. I mean, I wanted a record deal, man, and I wanted to be, you know, and of course, people like Strait, you know, Strait was already a big star, and Ricky Skaggs. And that was traditional country music in the 80s. And I wanted to, you know, I thought, man, these guys kind of broke the door down. I think that, and then when I got here and everybody kept saying, you need to write your own songs and find yourself. And I think out of all those years of wanting to be those guys, and, you know, hell, Tim, I was down to wearing those outfits on those jamborees and stuff. So when I got here, I got into songwriting. And then your question was, how did I get into the business end of it? I thought, well, this artist thing, it was like a lot of my friends were getting record deals and I'm writing with them. You know what I need to do is I need to take what I did in Berkeley Springs at that radio station and go through these and try to get a job at one of these major publishing companies and go through their catalogs. And all I need is just to go through them. Then I got to thinking, well, maybe I need to re-demo them so they can hear it in another way, but not change it a lot. Just make it newer, a 90s sound. That's when I decided to go into the business of doing the catalog. And nobody had done that. Nobody had done that.
What do you mean when you say you dug into the catalog?
It's amount of songs that these writers had written since the publishing companies began here. You know, I guess the first was Acuff Rose, and Cedarwood came along and Tree about the same time. And it was a collection of songs by these certain writers, I would say anywhere from about 1948 to our present day. So it was basically going through the catalog, is taking that song, finding the best 5 to 10 songs of a writer, and maybe more, and just keep doing them.
Nobody was doing that. Dale had a genius idea, and you had quite a lot of success with that, didn't you? Right? Well, like, maybe give us this. What was one of your earliest big breaks as a publisher doing that?
I think the biggest was, you know, like you said, nobody was doing it. It was fresh. I kind of did that early with radio, by doing that late night show thing. I mean, Eddie Stubbs was kind of doing something like that in D.C., but at almost about the same time I was doing it, and at the small radio station. So I just carried it on to Nashville and made a job out of it. There was no job, Tim. They made up that job. The first was George Strait. I think the first record was Paul Worley and I had joining offices together when we moved out of the old building, and we had to move right across the street from you now, where the old Capitol Records building used to be, the brick one where Big Loud is now. My office was in a closet. Matter of fact, when I was over there in Canabie in Sethenden one night, instead, I said, hey, we're standing in my closet right now. Amazing. The building hadn't been designed. I had the closet, and it was backed up to Worley's office. And Tammy Brown was his secretary. She used to beat on the door and say, turn it down, because Paul's here. And I said, hell no, because that's how Paul used to come through and go, hey, bring that song in here and play it to me. And because that's cranking up enough. And I think my first record was Joy White. And it's an old Bill Anderson song, which got him back into publishing or writing again, because he retired for so long. And we signed him at Tree and bought his Stallion catalog, Donna and I, an old song called On and On and On. And it was a flip side to an old Connie Smith record. And it was a cool little shuffle, because it kind of went in a way that just wasn't so 1-4-5 musical. It had this odd, I don't know, kind of a Jim Lauderdale type of melody, cool thing to it. It was just like one of those cooler shuffles. It was like, this loneliness goes on and on and on. And I redemoed it, and Joy White had a record on it. But the big one was George Strait, and it was The Love Bug, and another song called That's Where My Baby Feels at Home. It was the album right after Pure Country. And those songs were given to the legendary Rene Bell, who took them to George and got them cut. And also Irv. You know, I always took my songs to Irv too, you know. And he broke a lot of barriers for me.
What do you think makes a great record executive? What was it about those guys, a lot of whom we listed that you listed as well, were not only executives but producers. But what do you think made them so iconic?
They made a decision and they stuck to it. It wasn't run by a committee. It was run by a person that said, hey, this is going to be the single. This is going to be a record. And it was usually creative people or someone like Luke Lewis that knew marketing and knew, you know, he had a feel of what his audience, you know, was going to buy or not.
So, and he's saying all this because I can hear it. And what do you think makes a great song plugger? Like, what are the skills that you think, like, what kind of advice could you give our listeners that are listening, like, and they're thinking about getting into what we do? What do you think makes a great plugger?
Number one is meeting people and contacts and knowing what a great song is. You know, you have to have that installed in you. You know what I mean? Of whether you have that, if whether you was going to be an artist or not, or you as a musician, or being around it, I think that has to be in you. And I think your networking needs to be great. People have to like you. I mean, if you come off differently and you come off weird and shit and vibe everybody out, no, you're not going to get in the door after several times. That was the thing with us. I mean, I'd sit up all night long before I got in a room with Tony Brown. I listened to the same 5 songs about all night long. And you go, oh my God, I hope I have the song, the lyrics right and all this. But I think you have to have an instinct. I think you have to have a passion for it. You got to have a creative buzz. But when you get in these doors, you must bring the goods.
Let's reflect on like how you've seen things change in the industry, and I'm not one that thinks things just because they've changed have become bad. You know, it's just an evolution of where we're at. What about this evolution do you like? What about it's been challenging for you?
Well, I am not, as a lot of people know, I'm not a big email guy. I've learned how to do it over the years. I just think there needs to be a personal level there of seeing somebody and showing the excitement and being able to do our job. Like a lot of those George Strait cuts that I got through the years as a plugger, and some of my own things was because I got there and got it. I got in their face and I learned that. And not in their face. I mean, I was cool about it, but I went in, I showed aggression. I gave them the song, whether it was A&R or the artist. And I did my stick, you know, they played the song and I got emotional about it, especially during the A&R meetings. You know, I would get upset. Like I always made sure I didn't listen to a song, especially a ballad, enough that I couldn't reflect those feelings when I was playing it. And I was known for a long time of like breaking down in the middle of the song as a plugger or as a, you know. And that's just feel. That's not pretend. That's just completely coming out of you and feeling that. And I think the person that taught me that the most was a person named Hank Cochran, a great songwriter and the greatest song plugger that ever lived. He was my biggest mentor in Harlan. But Hank taught me he said, son, once you put your foot down, you never pick it back up. But over the years, I'm pretty damn confident over a hit song. I know a hit song. If there's anything I do, back to what you were saying there's not as much communication. There's not as enough like face-to-face to where it's hard to do that with an email.
I think it's the relational side. They don't get as much opportunity to build as deep of a relationship with them because everybody's busier doing more stuff. And it is much harder to build deep relationships like that with all of the players, with the producers, with A&R people. It's a little different, you know, because you are sending them via email more. You do get meetings, but it's just, I think their challenge is trying to build the relationships that we did because we just saw them all the time. They would let you in if you were good, you had a good catalog, and maybe that's some of it I see, you know.
Like we talked about the basics of getting in, and like I said, and you know, at that period of time, I was also writing songs. And I still am, not as much as I used to, but I was plugging the catalog. And later on, Sony hired me to do the day-to-day stuff. So I had to keep a real good balance with that, especially being as a writer. So I wrote at night and I never came home. You know what I mean? That's probably why that didn't work out very well in three situations. But, you know, but the deal is I lived down here on 16th, 17th Avenue. Because I was either working all day and plugging songs or being in the studio, getting them demos right, or doing a catalog or day-to-day things and having A&R meetings and all that, and then writing at night, I basically didn't go home. I lived that for over 30 years. In a lot of ways, this email and the Zooms and all that and all that's made things a lot different, a lot easier. It's just you lose the human contact, you know, and then showing those emotions through that song. Whether you're happy and going, woo, play it again, or you're crying along with the song, you can't show that anymore.
What is it that has kept you so passionate about through all these changes and transitions that keeps you keep wanting to do this job?
I think the main thing is, I don't know, I'm probably my own worst critic as far as, I know I don't come off like that. Some people probably think I'm an egotistical asshole over the years, and I have been. You know, when you're young and you get all these cuts and everybody's praising you and you're like, you're the man. Anyway, whatever. But the point is I think I'm my hardest critic. I've been up and down probably 3 or 4 times. You know, Johnny Paycheck told me one time, he said, you're going to have highs, you're going to have lows, and you're going to hit a lot of damn deals. But just make sure that when you're running hard enough that when you hit the ditch, you end up on the other side. I had to reinvent myself. We all do. I mean, you can't stick to something. I mean, I couldn't just stick to Sony Tree Catalog. I had to do something new. Something different is what I'm always looking for to keep your name relevant and try to readjust with what's all new coming on, because these kids are much smarter now. There's more of a professional thing that's happening too with the newer generation. And that's kudos to them. That's great. The stuff that I got by with, I should have been fired. I was very lucky, but I was very good at what I did. You know what I mean? I was good.
What is some of the best advice you've been given?
Show up on time. Be consistent. I think that's a big thing. With that being said, you know, I mean, after when I got at Sony, man, it was, I mean, and I could pull this in real quick for you, Cam, but Pat and Connie got me over there with Donna. You know, the Bradleys really helped me considerably. And Donna Healy, that's what I'm saying. I didn't want to go without saying her on this, because she is probably the biggest thing that changed my life, you know, with the others helping make that way. She gave me an opportunity, Tim. I mean, a country boy with no education from West Virginia. Shit. I mean, that was I went from that to meeting all my heroes.
What do you think Donna saw in you, man?
I think a young kid at 21, 22 that was hungry. And, you know, and she liked the fact that when I said that I knew the B-sides, she always said, Dale Dodson said he knows the B-sides. I don't know if she knew what the hell that meant. That was the B-side of the record, which, you know, being a deal. But I think she knew that. I think she saw in me what she saw in all those other people. And I told her I would never let her down. And I didn't. I mean, I fit in well with those guys, you know. And like, I was very, very lucky, Tim. I mean, I had to. Relationships and got songs recorded and wrote with, you know, Curly Pup and, you know, Jerry Chestnut and Mac Vickery and Red Lane, Harlan Howard, Hank Cocker. And I mean, I was in royalty. And Donna paved that for me and opened the door for me with a lot of those producers we talked about and the executives that we talked about. And, you know, I would say the two big business people that did that and had level heads was Donna, and then of course later on in the mid-90s, my relationship with Buck Owens. He was one of my heroes, man. His sound and everything, but as a businessman, he was iconic. He played a big role in the business side, you know, and Donna did, just like Hank Cochran with a song and a plugging side. You understand, Tim? Country music, the royalty, man. And it was all there. The past, and then now today, I just saw all these cool, right? I get to work with so many people, right? Yeah, I just don't want to leave anybody out, you know, like Dean Dillon, Tony Lane. And, you know, and I'll say it to this day, that building that starts off on 17th Avenue, that's Yankee Stadium.
The AIMP Nashville Pubcast is hosted by yours truly, Tim Hunzey, producer Brandon Harrington, mixing and editing by Casey Porter. And this has been a Dime Collective production.